Sometimes I wake up in a cold sweat. Soldiers marching through my mind. Seems I always have to tell myself that world is gone, it's far behind. We made a life here in this country. It's not perfect, but it's home. In every moment I am thankful this world is all you've ever known. Stood a lady in the harbor, spoke these words, held out your hand. We've come a long way, we yearn to breathe free. We hope that you will understand. We've come a long way, we yearn to breathe free. We hope that you will understand.
Listen to Mac Martin and the Dixie Travelers play I'm Working on a Banjo from 1968's With the Traveling Blues. Let me tell you about that last little set of music here on the Black Diamond Show. High Fidelity began it with Old Home Place from their 2020 record Banjo Players Blues. And no, it's not that Old Home Place. It's a new song with the title Old Home Place. Then Sister Sadie from back in 2018 gave us I Wash My Face in the Morning Dew from their record Sister Sadie 2. And Mile 12 from 2019 gave us Liberty from their record City on a Hill. Coming up next, Flat and Scruggs and all the Foggy Mountain Boys.
It was long, long ago in the moonlight, we were sitting on the banks of the stream. When you whispered so sweetly, I love you, as the waters murmured a tune. Oh, they tell me you love like flowers in the springtime blossoms so fast. In the fall when it withers away, dear, and they tell me that's the way of your love. I remember the night, little darling, we were talking of days gone by, when you told me you always would love me, that your love for me would never die. Oh, they tell me your love is like flowers in the springtime blossom so fair. In the fall when it weathers away, dear, and they tell
hello everybody, it's Charlotte. So for my show for Pandemonium, which is airing right now on WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM, I will be doing a little story time because because I'm assuming that most people who are listening to WRCT right now, whether that's one person or five people, I'm just assuming that they're mostly adults, and adults without children, and usually adults without children don't read stories enough, and stories are really important, and I don't have anything really meaningful or important to say myself, so just join me for 30 minutes of nice stories. I've got this book called Tales of the Unexpected by Roald Dahl. Maybe I'll read a few stories out of this. Maybe read some essays later. We'll see where this day takes us. But yeah, I hope you enjoy. So I lied. I'm not going to read anything from Tales of the Unexpected. I already recorded one of the stories, but I just wasn't really into it. It wasn't very interesting. And in the fast-paced world of radio, you know, you have to have something really exciting. So I want to read to you some stories from this book we read in my extreme ethnography class at Carnegie Mellon. It's called Ordinary Affect by Kathleen Stewart, and it's basically a collection of vignettes that the author, Stewart, has written, and they are about everyday life and the unexpected. And anyways, I'm just going to read to you some of these stories. So this one is called First Date. She stops in at a cafe on a town square in Ohio. Two middle-aged people sit awkwardly together at the next table. A thin, blonde, carefully tanned woman is having a grapefruit while the heavy-set, pasty man is eating biscuits and gravy. It's an odd scene, clearly their first meeting. The woman is talking about her workout schedule and what she eats. She says she's not obsessive about it, but she likes to keep her body in shape. She pulls out bottles of vitamins and herbal supplements. I take two of these when I wake up. These are with meals. These in the afternoon. These are good for energy if I feel a little low. She takes out lotion and rubs them into her skin. He maintains a careful look of interest, but things don't seem to be going well for him. A few minutes later, she hears the grapefruit woman say to the biscuit man, "Of course, you'd have to lose 30 pounds." He's nodding. "Of course, oh, yes." He's looking down at his biscuits and gravy. His eyes wander around the table at a level well below the range of possible eye contact. Then he lowers his head over his plate and eats. She wonders how these two people found each other. This is before internet dating, so maybe they used personal ads in the local newspaper. Maybe they were the only two single, middle-aged people in the county. Whatever it was an experiment, just to see what would happen. And things were happening, all right, even though it was not so happening. Color theory. Face-to-face interactions and common encounters jump in a quick relay to floating sensibilities and the conditions of connection that link us. In Las Vegas in the late 1980s, a post office outpost shares an ad hoc storefront with a flower shop and a gift shop sparsely filled with eclectic, inexpensive ceramics. At noon, when the post office and store are closed for lunch, a color therapy group sometimes uses the space. In one meeting, a dozen people sit in a circle on gray metal folding chairs. One man is talking about a relationship problem that has something to do with the fact that he's a magenta. The people in the group respond with intricate discussions of the shades of color and color combinations that connect different personal energies and styles. Then a young woman begins to talk about a problem at work that stems from her being a yellow. Now alternative health practitioners and mystics advertise color therapy on the web. They used colored gemstones, candles, wands, prisms, light bulbs, water, fabric, bath treatments, and eyewear to balance the body's energy and stimulate healing. Each color has a vibrational frequency. Warm colors are stimulating, cool colors are calming, and a strong attraction to certain colors might signal a particular imbalance. You can play a game with color codes if you want to. Red is active, daring, passionate, and optimistic. Red people are courageous, confident, humanistic, strong-willed, spontaneous, honest, and extroverted. Purple is grand, idealistic, and sensitive, but may lack self-criticism and maturity. Purple people make good, inspirational leaders. They are kindly and just, humanitarian, self-sacrificing, visionary, creative, and strong mentally. Magenta is less aggressive and more spiritual than red, and also more practical than purple. Yellow is intellectual and communicative. Yellow people are good-humored, optimistic, confident, practical, and intellectual. You can imagine yourself through the model of one of the types, or against it. Maybe you'd like to be orange. Orange is more ambitious and self-sufficient than red, but lacks its warmth. It has the intelligence of yellow without its loftiness. Orange people are enthusiastic, happy, sociable, energetic, sporty, self-assured, and constructive. But then you might think you're actually probably closer to a green. And that's on a good day. Green is healing, sympathetic, steadfast, and restrained. Green people are understanding, self-controlled, adaptable, sympathetic, compassionate, humble, generous, nature-loving, and romantic. You might begin to piece together combinations of colors and blends, making things up. But the people who are really into color therapy don't read colors as symbols or codes. They're into the real surface qualities of colors and what they can do. They don't care what colors mean. They're fooling around with the forces that be to see what things are made of. They want to set things in alchemical motion. They're talking things over with like-minded people. You never know. I used to have a lot of problems with frameworks like these for capturing people's personalities, like color therapy or theory and the Myers-Briggs test and astrology, because I've had kind of rough experiences with this in my life. Like, I'm a Pisces woman, just full disclosure, and I've had experiences with people where they would kind of just straight up tell me, I don't want to be friends with you because of your astrological sign. And like, how could we judge each other based off this made up framework of like personality? Like, there's no way that me being a Pisces actually says anything, correct? But people really take this stuff seriously, and I mean, there was the whole Indigo Children phenomenon where children were believed to be at like a higher level of consciousness or something because their auras were indigo, and in actuality their parents were just like narcissistic and didn't understand their children. I don't know why people love this stuff so much, but I feel like especially astrology these days is basically like a foundation for social communication, at least with a lot of people I know. Anyways, so what color are you? What's your astrological sign? What's your Myers-Briggs personality letters? Can we create a new framework of coming up with, like, I don't know, maybe we're different types of fish or something. This is getting kind of ridiculous. I'm going to read you the next story. This next story is called Just Do It. Meanwhile, down the street, at practically the very same moment that the color therapy group is meeting in the post office, a chemical factory explodes and blows up half the town of Henderson, Nevada. The FEMA hearings drag on for months. There's a testimony. Small businesses have been ruined by the blast. Unmarked trains carrying dangerous chemicals have been running along the edges of backyards where innocent children play. There's talk of secret big business operations supported by the federal government of callous disregard for future generations. She starts talking with the de facto leader of the small business owners. He feels slighted by FEMA. He and the others have confrontations with local politicians. There are sinister threats. There are fights. They're digging for dirt and finding plenty. Bob is devoting his life to the cause. He spends hundreds of dollars on long-distance phone calls every month. He organizes a campaign to unearth stories. The young man who was raising tarantulas and poisonous snakes in his apartment to pay for college and lost everything in the blast. The retired couple who came to the town looking for peace or something and who awoke that night to the sound of windows and glass doors smashing all over the house and the smell of gas. When Bob and the other small business owners get no satisfaction from the government, they decide to take things into their own hands. They come up with an idea to start over by building a chemical factory of their own. They already know plenty about manufacturing. This is America, and they can do anything. Someone says he knows an engineer who will work with them. Now they just need someone who knows something about chemicals. Okay, this thing is crazy to me. Just when the chemical factory explodes and you experience all of this loss and devastation, it would not be the first logical step in my mind to create a new chemical factory, but I guess I could see how it's this thing that must be replaced and they think they can do it better and in a safe way, but yeah, I was not expecting that. Anyways, I'll keep reading. Things keep getting worse. Bob is calling her every night. Then he's piecing together a conspiracy too big to talk about over the phone. She meets him in a church parking lot on the edge of town. The sunset is spectacular. Bob wants to tell her his life story. The big, beautiful, wild Nevada of his childhood. Hunting and fishing in a pure land. His return, years later, to start his own business and raise his children right. Then the explosion, just when he was beginning to get on his feet again. It's getting dark. He's talking too much about himself. She says she's talked to other people who have experiences like his and think the way he does. This makes him mad, much to her surprise. He's an individual. There's no one in the world like him. He isn't like anything. He comes on to her. She gets out of there, but now she's anxious and her stomach is queasy. He keeps calling. She visits him once more, this time at his house with his wife and children. There's no furniture left in the house. They sit on the carpet in the empty living room and eat pizza out of the box. Everyone's very quiet. It's scary and depressing. There's something just a little bit off and terribly wrong. Now he's mumbling bitterly about things she can't quite hear, and then she half realizes his talk has become lewd and is directed at her. This can't be happening. The air goes out of the room. She stands up and starts moving towards the door. She thanks his now wide-eyed wife. She leaves the house. He calls only once more, a couple days later, to report on the progress of his case with FEMA. She's cool with him on the phone, not encouraging him to keep in touch, keeping her distance too late. This next one is called Traces. People are collecting found objects snatched off the literal or metaphorical side of the road. Things that have dropped out of the loop or have been left sagging somewhere are dragged home as if they are literal residues of past dreaming practices. The snatching practice mixes a longing for a real world or something with the consumer's little dream of spying a gem or tripping over a bargain. And in the mix, all kinds of other things are happening too. This little nugget of wisdom really resonated with me because I'm a person who loves to collect things that are just lying around. My room is full of trash, but that's beside the point. Anyways, I was at school the other day, and in the hallway there was a fax machine that had a free sign on it, and I instantly thought, I must take this home. How could somebody just be giving away a fully functioning fax machine? Of course, I didn't know that it was fully functioning, but I just had assumed so because, I don't know, it just seemed like the kind of thing that people stopped using and they need to get rid of it, but they don't have the heart to throw it away. And I think that this is a phenomenon that so often occurs. Things that are basically trash, but people can't bear to throw away, and either that's because they feel terrible about, you know, the state of our planet, and they don't want to contribute to climate change and the accumulation of stuff in our landfills, or they think that it has some sort of value to it and maybe someone can make use of it. Well, regardless of whatever that was, or what was the case for this fax machine, I really wanted it. And I don't know, maybe something could be done with a fax machine. If I only had one friend, just one friend who could get a fax machine too, we could send each other faxes all the time, and this feels like a very novel idea. I have one friend that I like to send letters to, and even though letters are kind of a regular thing, they feel like such a novelty every time I send or receive one, even though it's been, you know, 5 or 6 years since we began this. And so I thought maybe this is just an expansion on how I can communicate with people I care about through fax machines. You know, I can send drawings instantly. But I don't have any friends with the fax machine, and so I don't know if this object would make any use on its own. At the same time, though, how could I let a treasure like this just go to waste? Collecting dust in the hallway, I'm pretty sure nobody else will pick it up. It's been there for 2 weeks now. And maybe I'll find more joy out of it than anyone or any landfill ever could, so is it my responsibility to take it? Speaking of having a house full of trash, or a room full of trash, I'm moving soon. And I'm currently living in this house that's been passed down from generation to generation of college students. So the lease has never really been completely reset. There's always been one person carrying it over from year to year for maybe the past 10, 15 years. So there's this giant accumulation of random things that you would assume a college student would pick up on the side of the road and bring into their home in our basement. And it's a scary basement. There's water everywhere. It smells a little weird. It's dank. It's dark. There's remnants of a Pittsburgh toilet. And there's just all of this stuff. There's a single boot, a few deflated basketballs. There are lots of suitcases. There are pillows. There are picture frames. There are soggy art materials. There's a sled. an IKEA bag. There's all kinds of stuff, and it will be a fantastic feat to clear all of it out before I have to change over to my next lease, because there's just so much stuff. But beyond the physical feat, it's just a crazy mental feat to be throwing away so much stuff all at once, even though it's not mine. It feels crazy to be contributing this much waste to the world. But it's stuff that's going to be in this world, whether it's in my house or in a landfill, so what difference does it make? Anyways, this is not really a story, but I guess, I don't know, somebody has to hear about it, so I'm telling all of you listening on the radio. I think it's time to switch gears. I've been talking about myself for a little too long, and by now probably nobody's listening anymore. So to start fresh, I picked up my book of essays by Joan Didion, and this one is called Holy Water. I'm from California, so this one, and I guess all of her work, is important to me. So I would like to share this with you today. Some of us who live in arid parts of the world think about water with a reverence others might find excessive. The water I will draw tomorrow from my tap in Malibu is today crossing the Mojave Desert from the Colorado River, and I like to think about exactly where the water is. The water I will drink tonight in a restaurant in Hollywood is by now well down the Los Angeles Aqueduct from the Owens River, and I also think about exactly where that water is. I particularly like to imagine it as it cascades down the 45-degree stone steps that aerate Owen's water after its airless passage through the mountain pipes and siphons. As it happens, my own reverence for water has always taken the form of this constant meditation upon where the water is, of an obsessive interest not in the politics of water but in the waterworks themselves, in the movement of water through aqueducts and siphons and pumps and forebays and afterbays and wires, weirs, and drains, I'm not really hip on all the water lingo, sorry, in plumbing on the grand scale. I know the data on water projects I will never see. I know that the difficulty Kaiser had closing the last two sluice, I've never seen this word before, sluiceway gates on the Guri Dam in Venezuela. I keep watching on evaporation behind the Aswan in Egypt. I can put myself to sleep imagining the water dropping 1,000 feet into the turbines at Churchill Falls in Labrador. If the Churchill Falls project fails to materialize, I fall back on waterworks closer at hand. The tail race at Hoover on the Colorado, the surge tank in the Tehachapi Mountains that receives the California Aqueduct water pumped higher than water has ever been pumped before, and finally, I replay a morning when I was 17 years old and caught in a military surplus life draft in the construction of the Nimbus Afterbay Dam on the American River near Sacramento. I remember that, at the moment it happened, I was trying to open a tin of anchovies with capers. I recall the raft spinning into the narrow chute through which the river had been temporarily diverted. I recall being deliriously happy. I suppose it was partly the memory of that delirium that led me to visit, one summer morning in Sacramento, the Operations Control Center for the California State Water Project. Actually, so much water is moved around California by so many different agencies that maybe only the movers themselves know on any given day whose water is where, but to get a general picture, it is necessary only to remember that Los Angeles moves some of it, San Francisco moves some of it, the Bureau of Reclamation's Central Valley Project moves some of it, and the California State Water Project moves most of the rest of it, moves a vast amount of it, moves more water farther than has ever been moved anywhere. They collect this water up in the granite keeps of the Sierra Nevada, and they store roughly 1 trillion gallons of it behind the Oroville Dam, and every morning, down at the project's headquarters in Sacramento, they decide how much of their water they want to move the next day. They make this morning decision according to supply and demand, which is simple in theory but rather more complicated in practice. In theory, each of the project's 5 field divisions, the Oroville, the Delta, the San Luis, and the San Joaquin, and the Southern divisions, places a call to the headquarters before 9 a.m. and tells the dispatchers how much water is needed by its local water contractors, who have in turn based their morning estimates on orders from growers and other big users. A schedule is made. The gates open and close according to the schedule. The water flows south and the deliveries are made. In practice, this requires prodigious coordination, precision, and the best efforts of several human minds and that of a UNIVAC 418. In practice, it might be necessary to hold large flows of water for power production, or to flush out encroaching salinity in the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta, the most ecologically sensitive point on the system. In practice, a sudden rain might obviate the need for a delivery when that delivery is already on its way. In practice, what is being delivered here is an enormous volume of water, not quarts of milk or spools of thread, and it takes 2 days to move such a delivery down the Oroville into the Delta, which is the great pooling place for California water and has been for some years alive with electronic sensors and telemetering equipment and men blocking channels and diverting flows and shoveling fish away from the pumps. It takes perhaps another 6 days to move the same water down the California aqueduct from the Delta to the Tehachapi and put it over the hill to Southern California. Putting some over the hill is what they say around the Project Operations Control Center when they want to indicate that they are pumping aqueduct water from the floor of the San Joaquin Valley up and over the Tehachapi Mountains. Pulling it down is what they say when they want to indicate that they are lowering a water level somewhere in the system. They can put some over the hill by remote control from this room in Sacramento with its UNIVAC and its big board and its flashing lights. They can pull down a pool in the San Joaquin by remote control from this room in Sacramento with its locked doors and its ringing sensors out there in the water itself. From this room in Sacramento, the whole system takes on the aspect of a perfect $3 billion hydraulic toy, and in certain ways it is. Let's start draining quail at 12 o'clock was the 10:51 a.m. entry on the electronically recorded communications log the day I visited the Operations Control Center. Quail is a reservoir in Los Angeles County with a gross capacity of, I cannot read this number out loud, but it's 16360180000 gallons. That is a lot. Okay, was the response recorded in the log. I knew at that moment that I had missed the only vocation for which I had any instinctive affinity. I wanted to drain quail myself. Not many people I know carry their end of the conversation when I want to talk about water deliveries, even when I stress that these deliveries affect their lives, indirectly, every day. Indirectly is not quite enough for most people I know. This morning, however, several people I know were affected not indirectly, but directly by the way the water moves. They had been in New Mexico shooting a picture, one sequence of which required a river deep enough to sink a truck, the kind with a cab driver and a trailer and 50 or 60 wheels. It so happened that no river near the New Mexico location was running that deep this year. The production was therefore moved today to Needles, California, where the Colorado River normally runs, depending upon releases from Davis Dam, 18 to 25 feet deep. Now, follow this closely. Yesterday we had a freak tropical storm in Southern California, 2 inches of rain in a normally dry mouth, and because this, rain flooded the fields and provided more irrigation than any grower could possibly want for several days. No water was ordered from Davis Dam. No orders, no releases. Supply and demand. As a result, the Colorado was running only 7 feet deep past Needles today. Sam Peckinpah's desire for 18 feet of water in which to sink a truck not being the kind of demand anyone at Davis Dam is geared to meet. The production closed down for the weekend. Shooting will resume Tuesday, providing some growers order water and the agencies controlling the Colorado release it. Meanwhile, many gaffers, best boys, cameramen, assistant directors, script supervisors, stunt drivers, and maybe even Sam Peckinpah are waiting out the weekend in Needles, where it is often 110 degrees at 5 p.m. and hard to get dinner after 8. This is a California parable, but a true one. I have always wanted a swimming pool, and never had one. When it became generally known a year or so ago that California was suffering a severe drought, many people in water-rich parts of the country seemed obscurely gratified and made frequent reference to Californians having to brick up their swimming pools. In fact, a swimming pool requires, once it has been filled and the filter has begun its process of cleaning and recirculating the water, virtually no water. But the symbolic content of swimming pools has always been interesting. A pool is misapprehended as a trapping of affluence, real or pretended, and of a kind of hedonistic attention to the body. Actually, a pool is, for many of us in the West, a symbol not of affluence but of order, of control over the uncontrollable. A pool is water, made available and useful, and is, as such, infinitely soothing to the Western eye. It is easy to forget that the only natural force over which we have any control out here is water, and that only recently. In my memory, California summers were characterized by the coughing in the pipes that meant the well was dry, and California winters by all-night watches on rivers about to crest, by sandbagging, by dynamite on the levees and flooding on the first floor. Even now, the place is not all that hospitable to extensive settlement. As I write, a fire has been burning out of control for 2 weeks in the ranges behind the Big Sur coast. Flash floods last night wiped out all major roads into Imperial County. I noticed this morning a hairline crack in a living room tile from last week's earthquake, a 4.4 I never felt. In the part of California where I now live, aridity is the single most prominent feature of the climate, and I am not pleased to see this year cactus spreading wild to the sea. There will be days this winter when the humidity will drop to 10, 7, 4. Tumbleweed will blow against my house and the sound of the rattlesnake will be duplicated 100 times a day by dried bougainvillea drifting in my driveway. The apparent ease of California life is an illusion, and those who believe the illusion is real live here only in the most temporary way. I know as well as the next person that there is considerable transcendent value in a river running wild and undammed, a river running free over granite, but I have also lived beneath such a river when it was running in flood, and gone without showers when it was running dry. The West begins, Bernardo Devoto wrote, where the average annual rainfall drops below 20 inches. This is maybe the best definition of the West I have ever read, and it goes a long way towards explaining my own passion for seeing the water under control, but many people I know persist in looking for psychoanalytical implications in this passion. As a matter of fact, I have explored, in an amateur way, the more obvious of these implications and come up with nothing interesting. A certain external reality remains, and resists interpretation. The West begins where the average annual rainfall drops below 20 inches. Water is important to people who do not have it, and the same is true of control. Some 15 years ago, I tore a poem by Carl Shapiro from a magazine and pinned it on my kitchen wall. This fragment of paper is now on the wall of a sixth kitchen and crumbles a little whenever I touch it. But I keep it there for the last stanza, which has for me the power of a prayer. It is raining in California, a straight rain, cleaning the heavy oranges on the bow, filling the gardens till the gardens flow, shining the olives, tiling the gleaming tile, waxing the dark camellia leaves more green, flooding the day-long valleys like the Nile. I thought of those lines almost constantly on the morning in Sacramento when I went to visit the California State Water Project Operations Control Center. If I had wanted to drain quail at 10:51 that morning, I wanted, by early afternoon, to do a great deal more. I wanted to open and close the Clifton Court 4-bay intake gate. I wanted to produce some power down at the San Luis Dam. I wanted to pick a pool at random on the aqueduct and pull it down and then refill it, watching for the hydraulic jump. I wanted to put some water over the hill, and I wanted to shut down all flow from the aqueduct into the Bureau of Reclamation's Cross Valley Canal, just to see how long it would take somebody over at Reclamation to call up and complain. I stayed as long as I could and watched the system work on the big board with the lighted checkpoints. The Delta salinity report was coming in on one of the teletypes behind me. The Delta tidal report was coming in on another. The earthquake board, which had been desensitized to sound its alarm, a beeping tone for Southern California, a high-pitched tone for the North, only for those earthquakes which register at least 3.0 on the Richter scale, was silent. I had no further business in this room, and yet I wanted to stay the day. I wanted to be the one that day who was shining the olives, filling the gardens, and flooding the day-long valleys like the Nile. I want it still. This was in 1977. Thank you so much for tuning in for my story time. I hope that you enjoyed the two stories that I read and tolerated the interjections on my reflections of the fax machine and red light therapy and stuff. Anyways, you've been listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. Hello everybody, it's Charlotte. So for my show for Pandemonium, which is airing right now on WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM, I will be doing a little story time, because I'm assuming that most people who are listening to WRCT right now, whether that's one person or five people, I'm just assuming that they're mostly adults, and adults without children, and usually adults without children don't read stories enough, and stories are really important, and I don't have anything really meaningful or important to say myself. So just join me for 30 minutes of nice stories. I've got this book called Tales of the Unexpected by Roald Dahl. Maybe I'll read a few stories out of this. Maybe read some essays later. We'll see where this day takes us. But yeah, I hope you enjoy. So I lied. I'm not going to read anything from Tales of the Unexpected. I already recorded one of the stories, but I just wasn't really into it. It wasn't very interesting. And in the fast-paced world of radio, you know, you have to have something really exciting. So I want to read to you some stories from this book we read in my extreme ethnography class at Carnegie Mellon. It's called Ordinary Affect by Kathleen Stewart, and it's basically a collection of vignettes that the author, Stewart, has written, and they are about everyday life and the unexpected. And anyways, I'm just going to read to you some of these stories. So this one is called First Date. She stops in at a cafe on a town square in Ohio. Two middle-aged people sit awkwardly together at the next table. A thin, blonde, carefully tanned woman is having a grapefruit while the heavy-set, pasty man is eating biscuits and gravy. It's an odd scene, clearly their first meeting. The woman is talking about her workout schedule and what she eats. She says she's not obsessive about it, but she likes to keep her body in shape. She pulls out bottles of vitamins and herbal supplements. I take two of these when I wake up. These are with meals. These in the afternoon. These are good for energy if I feel a little low. She takes out lotion and rubs them into her skin. He maintains a careful look of interest, but things don't seem to be going well for him. A few minutes later, she hears the grapefruit woman say to the biscuit man, "Of course, you'd have to lose 30 pounds. He's nodding. "Of course, oh, yes. He's looking down at his biscuits and gravy. His eyes wander around the table at a level well below the range of possible eye contact. Then he lowers his head over his plate and eats. She wonders how these two people found each other. This is before internet dating, so maybe they used personal ads in the local newspaper. Maybe they were the only two single, middle-aged people in the county. Whatever it was an experiment, just to see what would happen. And things were happening, all right, even though it was not so happening. Color theory. Face-to-face interactions and common encounters jump in a quick relay to floating sensibilities and the conditions of connection that link us. In Las Vegas in the late 1980s, a post office outpost shares an ad hoc storefront with a flower shop and a gift shop sparsely filled with eclectic, inexpensive ceramics. At noon, when the post office and store are closed for lunch, a color therapy group sometimes uses the space. In one meeting, a dozen people sit in a circle on gray metal folding chairs. One man is talking about a relationship problem that has something to do with the fact that he's a magenta. The people in the group respond with intricate discussions of the shades of color and color combinations that connect different personal energies and styles. Then a young woman begins to talk about a problem at work that stems from her being a yellow. Now alternative health practitioners and mystics advertise color therapy on the web. They used colored gemstones, candles, wands, prisms, light bulbs, water, fabric, bath treatments, and eyewear to balance the body's energy and stimulate healing. Each color has a vibrational frequency. Warm colors are stimulating, cool colors are calming, and a strong attraction to certain colors might signal a particular imbalance. You can play a game with color codes if you want to. Red is active, daring, passionate, and optimistic. Red people are courageous, confident, humanistic, strong-willed, spontaneous, honest, and extroverted. Purple is grand, idealistic, and sensitive, but may lack self-criticism and maturity. Purple people make good inspirational leaders. They are kindly and just, humanitarian, self-sacrificing, visionary, creative, and strong mentally. Magenta is less aggressive and more spiritual than red, and also more practical than purple. Yellow is intellectual and communicative. Yellow people are good-humored, optimistic, confident, practical, and intellectual. You can imagine yourself through the model of one of the types, or against it. Maybe you'd like to be orange. Orange is more ambitious and self-sufficient than red, but lacks its warmth. It has the intelligence of yellow without its loftiness. Orange people are enthusiastic, happy, sociable, energetic, sporty, self-assured, and constructive. But then you might think you're actually probably closer to a green. And that's on a good day. Green is healing, sympathetic, steadfast, and restrained. Green people are understanding, self-controlled, adaptable, sympathetic, compassionate, humble, generous, nature-loving, and romantic. You might begin to piece together combinations of colors and blends, making things up. But the people who are really into color therapy don't read colors as symbols or codes. They're into the real surface qualities of colors and what they can do. They don't care what colors mean. They're fooling around with the forces that be to see what things are made of. They want to set things in alchemical motion. They're talking things over with like-minded people. You never know. I used to have a lot of problems with frameworks like these for capturing people's personalities, like color therapy or theory and the Myers-Briggs test and astrology, because I've had kind of rough experiences with this in my life. Like, I'm a Pisces woman, just full disclosure, and I've had experiences with people where they would kind of just straight up tell me, I don't want to be friends with you because of your astrological sign. And like, how could we judge each other based off this made up framework of like personality? Like, there's no way that me being a Pisces actually says anything, correct? But people really take this stuff seriously, and I mean, there was the whole indigo children phenomenon where children were believed to be at like a higher level of consciousness or something because their auras were indigo, and in actuality their parents were just like narcissistic and didn't understand their children. I don't know why people love this stuff so much, but I feel like especially astrology these days is basically like a foundation for social communication, at least with a lot of people I know. Anyways, so what color are you? What's your astrological sign? What's your Myers-Briggs personality letters? Can we create a new framework of coming up with, like, I don't know, maybe we're different types of fish or something. This is getting kind of ridiculous. I'm going to read you the next story. This next story is called Just Do It. Meanwhile, down the street, at practically the very same moment that the color therapy group is meeting in the post office, a chemical factory explodes and blows up half the town of Henderson, Nevada. The FEMA hearings drag on for months. There's a testimony. Small businesses have been ruined by the blast. Unmarked trains carrying dangerous chemicals have been running along the edges of backyards where innocent children play. There's talk of secret big business operations supported by the federal government of callous disregard for future generations. She starts talking with the de facto leader of the small business owners. He feels slighted by FEMA. He and the others have confrontations with local politicians. There are sinister threats. There are fights. They're digging for dirt and finding plenty. Bob is devoting his life to the cause. He spends hundreds of dollars on long-distance phone calls every month. He organizes a campaign to unearth stories. The young man who was raising tarantulas and poisonous snakes in his apartment to pay for college and lost everything in the blast. The retired couple who came to the town looking for peace or something and who awoke that night to the sound of windows and glass doors smashing all over the house and the smell of gas. When Bob and the other small business owners get no satisfaction from the government, they decide to take things into their own hands. They come up with an idea to start over by building a chemical factory of their own. They already know plenty about manufacturing. This is America, and they can do anything. Someone says he knows an engineer who will work with them. Now they just need someone who knows something about chemicals. Okay, this thing is crazy to me. Just when the chemical factory explodes and you experience all of this loss and devastation, it would not be the first logical step in my mind to create a new chemical factory, but I guess I could see how it's this thing that must be replaced and they think they can do it better and in a safe way, but yeah, I was not expecting that. Anyways, I'll keep reading. Things keep getting worse. Bob is calling her every night. Then he's piecing together a conspiracy too big to talk about over the phone. She meets him in a church parking lot on the edge of town. The sunset is spectacular. Bob wants to tell her his life story. The big, beautiful, wild Nevada of his childhood. Hunting and fishing in a pure land. His return years later to start his own business and raise his children right. Then the explosion, just when he was beginning to get on his feet again. It's getting dark. He's talking too much about himself. She says she's talked to other people who have experiences like his and think the way he does. This makes him mad, much to her surprise. He's an individual. There's no one in the world like him. He isn't like anything. He comes on to her. She gets out of there, but now she's anxious and her stomach is queasy. He keeps calling. She visits him once more, this time at his house with his wife and children. There's no furniture left in the house. They sit on the carpet in the empty living room and eat pizza out of the box. Everyone's very quiet. It's scary and depressing. There's something just a little bit off and terribly wrong. Now he's mumbling bitterly about things she can't quite hear, and then she half realizes his talk has become lewd and is directed at her. This can't be happening. The air goes out of the room. She stands up and starts moving towards the door. She thanks his now wide-eyed wife. She leaves the house. He calls only once more, a couple days later, to report on the progress of his case with FEMA. She's cool with him on the phone, not encouraging him to keep in touch, keeping her distance too late. This next one is called Traces. People are collecting found objects snatched off the literal or metaphorical side of the road. Things that have dropped out of the loop or have been left sagging somewhere are dragged home as if they are literal residues of past dreaming practices. The snatching practice mixes a longing for a real world or something with the consumer's little dream of spying a gem or tripping over a bargain. And in the mix, all kinds of other things are happening too. This little nugget of wisdom really resonated with me because I'm a person who loves to collect things that are just lying around. My room is full of trash, but that's beside the point. Anyways, I was at school the other day, and in the hallway there was a fax machine that had a free sign on it, and I instantly thought, I must take this home. How could somebody just be giving away a fully functioning fax machine? Of course, I didn't know that it was fully functioning, but I just had assumed so because, I don't know, it just seemed like the kind of thing that people stopped using and they need to get rid of it, but they don't have the heart to throw it away. And I think that this is a phenomenon that so often occurs. Things that are basically trash, but people can't bear to throw away. And either that's because they feel terrible about, you know, the state of our planet and they don't want to contribute to climate change and the accumulation of stuff in our landfills, or they think that it has some sort of value to it and maybe someone can make use of it. Well, regardless of whatever that was, or what was the case for this fax machine, I really wanted it. And I don't know, maybe something could be done with a fax machine. If I only had one friend, just one friend who could get a fax machine too, we could send each other faxes all the time, and this feels like a very novel idea. I have one friend that I like to send letters to, and even though letters are kind of a regular thing, they feel like such a novelty every time I send or receive one, even though it's been, you know, 5 or 6 years since we began this. And so I thought maybe this is just an expansion on how I can communicate with people I care about through fax machines. You know, I can send drawings instantly. But I don't have any friends with the fax machine, and so I don't know if this object would make any use on its own. At the same time, though, how could I let a treasure like this just go to waste? Collecting dust in the hallway, I'm pretty sure nobody else will pick it up. It's been there for 2 weeks now. And maybe I'll find more joy out of it than anyone or any landfill ever could, so is it my responsibility to take it? Speaking of having a house full of trash, or a room full of trash, I'm moving soon. And I'm currently living in this house that's been passed down from generation to generation of college students. So the lease has never really been completely reset. There's always been one person carrying it over from year to year for maybe the past 10, 15 years. So there's this giant accumulation of random things that you would assume a college student would pick up on the side of the road and bring into their home in our basement. And it's a scary basement. There's water everywhere. It smells a little weird. It's dank. It's dark. There's remnants of a Pittsburgh toilet. And there's just all of this stuff. There's a single boot, a few deflated basketballs. There are lots of suitcases. There are pillows. There are picture frames. There are soggy art materials. There's a sled, an IKEA bag. There's all kinds of stuff, and it will be a fantastic feat to clear all of it out before I have to change over to my next lease, because there's just so much stuff. But beyond the physical feat. It's just a crazy mental feat to be throwing away so much stuff all at once, even though it's not mine. It feels crazy to be contributing this much waste to the world. But it's stuff. It's stuff that's going to be in this world, whether it's in my house or in a landfill. So what difference does it make? Anyways, this is not really a story, but I guess, I don't know. Somebody has to hear about it, so I'm telling all of you listening on the radio. I think it's time to switch gears. I've been talking about myself for a little too long, and by now probably nobody's listening anymore. So to start fresh, I picked up my book of essays by Joan Didion, and this one is called Holy Water. I'm from California, so this one, and I guess all of her work, is important to me. So I would like to share this with you today. Some of us who live in arid parts of the world think about water with a reverence others might find excessive. The water I will draw tomorrow from my tap in Malibu is today crossing the Mojave Desert from the Colorado River, and I like to think about exactly where the water is. The water I will drink tonight in a restaurant in Hollywood is by now well down the Los Angeles Aqueduct from the Owens River, and I also think about exactly where that water is. I particularly like to imagine it as it cascades down the 45-degree stone steps that aerate Owens water after its airless passage through the mountain pipes and siphons. As it happens, my own reverence for water has always taken the form of this constant meditation upon where the water is, of an obsessive interest not in the politics of water but in the waterworks themselves, in the movement of water through aqueducts and siphons and pumps and forebays and afterbays and wires, weirs, and drains. I'm not really hip on all the water lingo, sorry. In plumbing on the grand scale. I know the data on water projects I will never see. I know that the difficulty Kaiser had closing the last two sluice? I've never seen this word before. Gates? Sluiceway gates on the Guri Dam in Venezuela. I keep watching on evaporation behind the Aswan in Egypt. I can put myself to sleep imagining the water dropping 1,000 feet into the turbines at Churchill Falls in Labrador. If the Churchill Falls project fails to materialize, I fall back on waterworks closer at hand. The tail race at Hoover on the Colorado, the surge tank in the Tehachapi Mountains that receives the California Aqueduct water pumped higher than water has ever been pumped before, and finally, I replay a morning when I was 17 years old and caught in a military surplus life draft in the construction of the Nimbus Afterbay Dam on the American River near Sacramento. I remember that at the moment it happened, I was trying to open a tin of anchovies with capers. I recall the raft spinning into the narrow chute through which the river had been temporarily diverted. I recall being deliriously happy. I suppose it was partly the memory of that delirium that led me to visit, one summer morning in Sacramento, the Operations Control Center for the California State Water Project. Actually, so much water is moved around California by so many different agencies that maybe only the movers themselves know on any given day whose water is where, but to get a general picture, it is necessary only to remember that Los Angeles moves some of it, San Francisco moves some of it, the Bureau of Reclamation's Central Valley Project moves some of it, and the California State Water Project moves most of the rest of it, moves a vast amount of it, moves more water farther than has ever been moved anywhere. They collect this water up in the granite keeps of the Sierra Nevada, and they store roughly 1 trillion gallons of it behind the Oroville Dam, and every morning, down at the project's headquarters in Sacramento, they decide how much of their water they want to move the next day. They make this morning decision according to supply and demand, which is simple in theory but rather more complicated in practice. In theory, each of the project's 5 field divisions, the Oroville, the Delta, the San Luis, and the San Joaquin, and the Southern divisions, places a call to the headquarters before 9 a.m. and tells the dispatchers how much water is needed by its local water contractors, who have in turn based their morning estimates on orders from growers and other big users. A schedule is made. The gates open and close according to the schedule. The water flows south and the deliveries are made. In practice, this requires prodigious coordination, precision, and the best efforts of several human minds and that of a UNIVAC 418. In practice, it might be necessary to hold large flows of water for power production or to flush out encroaching salinity in the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta, the most ecologically sensitive point on the system. In practice, a sudden rain might obviate the need for a delivery when that delivery is already on its way. In practice, what is being delivered here is an enormous volume of water, not quarts of milk or spools of thread, and it takes 2 days to move such a delivery down the Oroville into the Delta, which is the great pooling place for California water and has been for some years alive with electronic sensors and telemetering equipment and men blocking channels and diverting flows and shoveling fish away from the pumps. It takes perhaps another 6 days to move this same water down the California Aqueduct from the Delta to the Tehachapi and put it over the hill to Southern California. Putting some over the hill is what they say around the Project Operations Control Center when they want to indicate that they are pumping aqueduct water from the floor of the San Joaquin Valley up and over the Tehachapi Mountains. Pulling it down is what they say when they want to indicate that they are lowering a water level somewhere in the system. They can put some over the hill by remote control from this room in Sacramento with its UNIVAC and its big board and its flashing lights. They can pull down a pool in the San Joaquin by remote control from this room in Sacramento with its locked doors and its ringing sensors out there in the water itself. From this room in Sacramento, the whole system takes on the aspect of a perfect $3 billion hydraulic toy, and in certain ways it is. Let's start draining quail at 12 o'clock was the 10:51 a.m. entry on the electronically recorded communications log the day I visited the Operations Control Center. Quail is a reservoir in Los Angeles County with a gross capacity of, I cannot read this number out loud, but it's 16360180000 gallons. That is a lot. Okay, was the response recorded in the log. I knew at that moment that I had missed the only vocation for which I had any instinctive affinity. I wanted to drain quail myself. Not many people I know carry their end of the conversation when I want to talk about water deliveries, even when I stress that these deliveries affect their lives, indirectly, every day. Indirectly is not quite enough for most people I know. This morning, however, several people I know were affected not indirectly, but directly by the way the water moves. They had been in New Mexico shooting a picture, one sequence of which required a river deep enough to sink a truck, the kind with a cab driver and a trailer and 50 or 60 wheels. It so happened that no river near the New Mexico location was running that deep this year. The production was therefore moved today to Needles, California, where the Colorado River normally runs, depending upon releases from Davis Dam, 18 to 25 feet deep. Now, follow this closely. Yesterday we had a freak tropical storm in Southern California, 2 inches of rain in a normally dry mouth, and because of this, rain flooded the fields and provided more irrigation than any grower could possibly want for several days. No water was ordered from Davis Dam. No orders, no releases. Supply and demand. As a result, the Colorado was running only 7 feet deep past Needles today. Sam Peckinpah's desire for 18 feet of water in which to sink a truck not being the kind of demand anyone at Davis Dam is geared to meet. The production closed down for the weekend. Shooting will resume Tuesday, providing some growers order water and the agencies controlling the Colorado release it. Meanwhile, many gaffers, best boys, cameramen, assistant directors, script supervisors, stunt drivers, and maybe even Sam Peckinpah are waiting out the weekend in Needles, where it is often 110 degrees at 5 p.m. and hard to get dinner after 8. This is a California parable, but a true one. I have always wanted a swimming pool, and never had one. When it became generally known a year or so ago that California was suffering a severe drought, many people in water-rich parts of the country seemed obscurely gratified and made frequent reference to Californians having to brick up their swimming pools. In fact, a swimming pool requires, once it has been filled and the filter has begun its process of cleaning and recirculating the water, virtually no water. But the symbolic content of swimming pools has always been interesting. A pool is misapprehended as a trapping of affluence, real or pretended, and of a kind of hedonistic attention to the body. Actually, a pool is, for many of us in the West, a symbol not of affluence but of order, of control over the uncontrollable. A pool is water, made available and useful, and is, as such, infinitely soothing to the Western eye. It is easy to forget that the only natural force over which we have any control out here is water, and that only recently. In my memory, California summers were characterized by the coughing in the pipes that meant the well was dry, and California winters by all-night watches on rivers about to crest, by sandbagging, by dynamite on the levees and flooding on the first floor. Even now, the place is not all that hospitable to extensive settlement. As I write, a fire has been burning out of control for 2 weeks in the ranges behind the Big Sur coast. Flash floods last night wiped out all major roads into Imperial County. I noticed this morning a hairline crack in a living room tile from last week's earthquake, a 4.4 I never felt. In the part of California where I now live, aridity is the single most prominent feature of the climate, and I am not pleased to see this year cactus spreading wild to the sea. There will be days this winter when the humidity will drop to 10, 7, 4. Tumbleweed will blow against my house and the sound of the rattlesnake will be duplicated 100 times a day by dried bougainvillea drifting in my driveway. The apparent ease of California life is an illusion, and those who believe the illusion is real live here only in the most temporary way. I know as well as the next person that there is considerable transcendent value in a river running wild and undammed, a river running free over granite, but I have also lived beneath such a river when it was running in flood and gone without showers when it was running dry. The West begins, Bernardo Devoto wrote, where the average annual rainfall drops below 20 inches. This is maybe the best definition of the West I have ever read, and it goes a long way towards explaining my own passion for seeing the water under control, but many people I know persist in looking for psychoanalytical implications in this passion. As a matter of fact, I have explored, in an amateur way, the more obvious of these implications and come up with nothing interesting. A certain external reality remains, and resists interpretation. The West begins where the average annual rainfall drops below 20 inches. Water is important to people who do not have it, and the same is true of control. Some 15 years ago, I tore a poem by Carl Shapiro from a magazine and pinned it on my kitchen wall. This fragment of paper is now on the wall of a sixth kitchen and crumbles a little whenever I touch it, but I keep it there for the last stanza, which has for me the power of a prayer. It is raining in California, a straight rain, cleaning the heavy oranges on the bow, filling the gardens till the gardens flow, shining the olives, tiling the gleaming tile, waxing the dark camellia leaves more green, flooding the daylong valleys like the Nile. I thought of those lines almost constantly on the morning in Sacramento when I went to visit the California State Water Project Operations Control Center. If I had wanted to drain quail at 10:51 that morning, I wanted, by early afternoon, to do a great deal more. I wanted to open and close the Clifton Court 4-bay intake gate. I wanted to produce some power down at the San Luis Dam. I wanted to pick a pool at random on the aqueduct and pull it down and then refill it, watching for the hydraulic jump. I wanted to put some water over the hill, and I wanted to shut down all flow from the aqueduct into the Bureau of Reclamation's Cross Valley Canal, just to see how long it would take somebody over at Reclamation to call up and complain. I stayed as long as I could and watched the system work on the big board with the lighted checkpoints. The Delta Salinity Report was coming in on one of the teletypes behind me. The Delta Tidal Report was coming in on another. The earthquake board, which had been desensitized to sound its alarm, a beeping tone for Southern California, a high-pitched tone for the North, only for those earthquakes which register at least 3.0 on the Richter scale, was silent. I had no further business in this room, and yet I wanted to stay the day. I wanted to be the one that day who was shining the olives, filling the gardens, and flooding the daylong valleys like the Nile. I want it still. This was in 1977. Thank you so much for tuning in for my story time. I hope that you enjoyed the two stories that I read and tolerated the interjections on my reflections of the fax machine and red light therapy and stuff. Anyways, you've been listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
What kind of help does the IRS have for identity theft victims?
If you suspect you're a victim of tax-related identity theft, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn how to prevent potential refund fraud and protect your tax account. At the IRS, combating tax-related identity theft is a top priority, and we are committed to prevention, detection, and assisting victims. And we're working with law enforcement to catch the criminals. For more info, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn what the IRS is doing to help protect you.
You are listening to 88.3 FM, WRCT Pittsburgh, streaming online at wrct.org.
Shop.